Well, thank you very much, Neil, and thank you very much for the invitation. It's my pleasure to be in sunny Canada. So I want to talk about simulations of cosmological structure and machine learning. Let me just begin by introducing the idea of cosmological simulation. So what is a cosmological simulation? So in my mind, it is a simulation of anything with a large enough box such that you have a fair sample of structures, right? So the idea is that you chop out a slice of between 20 and megaparsecs and 1 gigaparsec of the early universe at some time initially early that everything, the density field is roughly uniform. Not completely uniform, of course, but roughly uniform. And you evolve it forward until some redshift that you're interested in. And the idea here is that then it forms a sufficiently large number of high mass halos all the way down to low mass halos. And to ensure that the structure is a fair sample, you want to have a large enough box, ideally, that the scale on the size of the box is still well described by linear perturbation theory. When I'm talking about cosmological simulations here, I'm going to be talking about so-called full physics simulations. So these are things which contain not just gravity, but also prescriptions for galaxy formation. I'll talk about more about what that means, but you should imagine that inside every dark matter halo, there is gas. There are stars forming. The gas gets enriched with metals, and you can follow the neutral fraction as well. So why are we interested in doing this? Why is this an important thing to do? So there are three reasons. So the first, of course, is for galaxy formation. If you want to put galaxy formation in a simulation, then studying the way galaxies form is a reasonable thing to do with it. The second thing you might want to do is dark matter, and the third is cosmology. I'll go into detail about that. So that's just a slide for the purposes of making this point about galaxy formation. So what is one of the questions in galaxy formation that you're interested in? So you might be interested in how the gas on the left here, I have some neutral hydrogen, becomes stars, which is shown on here on the right. So this is a star formation rate, and this is the abundance of dense neutral hydrogen absorbers. And these guys turn into that. And you can study that in cosmological simulations. A second thing that you might potentially be interested in is dark matter. Why are cosmological simulations a good thing to do to understand dark matter? So dark matter is 5/6 of the matter in the universe. We know this because we've observed cosmic structure, right? It's important to know that the only place that we have any real evidence that dark matter exists is in cosmological structure. If you want to do something to your dark matter, if you want to make the model of dark matter non-minimal, if you want to give it some coupling, if you want to make any effect you can think of to it, a natural place to look for the effect of these couplings is in its imprint in cosmological structure. Right? And many people do this. However, you can only get at the effect of these non-minimal models on cosmic structure if you understand how cosmic structure is going to form in the first place. Right, so in order to be able to place some constraints on dark matter models, you need to have some very good understanding of what's going on in the universe, with galaxies, and with all the galaxy formation effects that move matter around, even in the absence of a non-minimal dark matter. So I would argue that running these kinds of full physics simulation is a very important thing to do for this reason. And the third reason for simulations, of course, is for cosmology. So this is a cosmology seminar, so you probably know about this, but you can use these things for parameter estimation. So if you had a large number of simulations with different cosmologies, you could run a whole bunch of them, and you could compute some summary statistics. So shown on the right, I have the matter power spectrum. You could also use the galaxy power spectrum. And you could compare the summary statistic to the results of some survey. So these are three useful things you can do. How do you do these things? So how do you run a cosmological simulation? Here on the right, I've shown a marketing picture from our latest simulation, which is Astrid, which I'll come to in a minute. And you can see there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. Right? So on the far right, I've shown this dark matter density here. Then I'm showing the gas temperature, the gas metallicity, and the neutral hydrogen fraction. And I'm zooming in on this part of the box here, which contains the largest halo. zooming in on it and then zooming in on the central region again. So from 50 megaparsecs across to 2 megaparsecs to 200 kiloparsecs, and then the galaxy right in the middle, which is maybe 10 kiloparsecs across. So this box contains a lot of stuff. It contains a lot of physics. Things that you need, modules that you need, are dark matter and gravity, of course. You need something to do gas pressure. You need something to do the gas cooling, the ionization. You need a prescription, a subgrid prescription for the effect of supernova heating, which you can't really resolve physically. And you need a subgrid prescription for the effect of black hole heating and merging. Let me go into a couple of these. Let me talk about the gravity first. You don't often hear people giving talks about hydrosimulations talking about the gravity. And that's just because it's not, you know, it's well understood, right? There's not a lot new that you can say about the gravity. However, it is very important, right? If you don't get the gravity right in one of these simulations, you're certainly not going to be able to understand how dark matter clusters, and you're not going to get the right answer, right? Gravity dominates the physical processes that go on in structure formation. The technique that we all use is to chop up the initial uniform density fluid into a bunch of collisionless particles. Essentially, we're Monte Carlo sampling the density field. You can kind of describe how big a simulation is by the number of collisionless particles we have. So for example, illustrious TNG has 1,820 cubed particles, so 1820 per linear side. Asteroid, shown here, has 5,500 cubed, which is a lot. And a state-of-the-art dark matter-only simulation, just for comparison, such as you would run such as they run in Fermilab, has about 10,000 cubed. Okay, so the extra physics that we add to a hydro simulation has a cost in terms of the particle load and in terms of the resolution, but maybe a lower cost than formally. Other things that are important. So I don't want to go through the whole list, but another sort of standard prescription that goes into simulations is the heating from black holes, right? So this is, I think, the leading, for cosmology and for dark matter, this is the leading order galaxy formation effect. This is the thing that's the largest effect. And the reason it's the largest effect is that the AGN, the central supermassive black hole in a halo, is able to expel gas from a large halo to about one megaparsec distance. So it's able to move gas a long way. This shows up in the power spectrum. So if you're trying to use a summary statistic like the galaxy power spectrum to measure cosmology, you have difficulties because it's being moved 20-30% by the heating of the black hole at redshift zero. There's actually an order of magnitude way to understand this number, this 20-30%, and that is that it is omega baryon divided by omega matter squared, right? The power spectrum is delta squared. Essentially, to zeroth order, to order of magnitude, what you're doing is you're taking out all the baryons in the halo with your black hole heating. The power spectrum of small scales is dominated by the one halo term, the density distribution inside the largest halos. So it gets suppressed by this factor omega b over omega matter. These are subgrid models, so we can't resolve the scales on which the matter accretes onto the black hole. Because we can't resolve these scales, we can't know how the energy gets distributed in the gas properly. So we rely on this subgrid prescription, where essentially we tune our simulations to produce the right number of stars, and then we see, you know, what this does to the rest of the simulation. But you know, it's not, you know, fully understood at this point, and has the potential to, if we're not careful, to cause difficulties for us who are interested in dark matter and interested in cosmology.
Can I ask, about this numerology? As you were saying before, the baryon fraction is a fifth or a sixth or something.
Right.
And so if I squared that, that would be a 30th.
What I'm saying is, if you square 5/6, you get 25 over 36, right? Which is about 2/3. Which is, the power spectrum drops from 1 to about 80-70%. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, sorry.
Right, yeah, so this, this, you know, this is this omega b over omega matter is 5/6 squared is 25/36. So it kind of works out. It's not, you know, plus or minus 10%, right? It's order of magnitude. Okay. Is that okay?
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yeah. where was I? Yeah. Okay. So this is, you know, this is not well understood, right? So you have to be careful about this. I've put here, this is a plot of matter power spectra. The dotted lines are linear theory and the solid lines are from the simulation. This is a much more high redshift power spectra. And the reason for that is simply the asteroid is currently past redshift 3, but did not yet pass redshift 2. So that was how far I could get. This is a slightly strange plot. The reason this plot is here is to make the point this is a slightly strange plot for this slide, because black hole heating is really mostly important at low redshift. So if you go to higher redshift, particularly redshift 4 to 6, you don't have enough high mass halos that the AGM feedback really has a big effect here. Redshift 3, sorry, is that a question? It's already...
Hi, Siva.
Hey.
Yeah, so what about other statistics? Like if you would like to go beyond power spectrum and measure something like bispectrum or so, will that be useful for this sector?
I have not done that. That's a good question. You're basically asking, would the black hole have an effect on the bispectrum?
I'm asking the kind of imprint we have on the power spectrum. Can we get some things from higher order statistics? Like instead of just calculating one from higher statistics, can I go beyond and ask like at those scales of like, one H over megaparsec and above, will my bispectrum show off something interesting? And you are saying that it is not being explored much yet?
I think that is not explored much yet, yes. I think it would do something. I don't know where the degeneracies would go, sorry. But yes, that's an interesting question. I haven't seen the paper that does that. maybe I just haven't seen it. I don't know. But no, that's an interesting question. So just to recap, these are the things that go into the simulation. For this Astro simulation, we were really interested in running things at high redshift, because there's a number of high redshift missions coming up. So there's JWST and there'll be W for Roman in a few years, and so for this reason, we put in a bunch of other things. Oh, sorry, no, wrong slide. This new simulation that I've been showing is the Astro simulation, which is named after Pippi Longstocking, because that's Tiziana's favorite cartoon character. This is a 250 megaparsec box. It has 2 × 5,500 cube particles. So 5,500 dark matter particles, 5,500 initial gas particles. The idea here is that we have a big enough box that we have a decent sample of Milky Way halos at redshifts 5 and 4. Right, so the idea here is that we are designed to have a big enough box with enough resolution for galaxy formation that we can do high redshift stuff. So this is just to convince you that it works. This is the UV luminosity function, which is the most reliable observational galaxy formation like thing in high redshift. And you can see that the solid line is the simulation, and the data points are the data, and they're close enough. They're close enough for the somewhat uncertain state of high redshift astrophysics at this point. The difference between the gray line and the blue line is dust extinction. The dust extinction is empirically fit to the simulation, but it's empirically fit at redshift 4, and then the same fit is used at higher redshifts. So there is some predictive power going on here, right? It's not a coincidence that this amount is the right amount, but it is a prediction that this suppression is the right amount. Okay. Because we're interested in high redshift, I put in some other physics models. I put in a model for hydrogen reionization. That seems like a useful thing to have at high redshift. If you want to know how galaxies form at redshift 6, then hydrogen reionization is a good way to go. I put in a model for helium reionization, a redshift 4 to 3, which I'm not really going to talk about, but it's in there. This is the grid of reionizations. This is a 250 megaparsec box, and this is the redshift of reionization in each point. The way that the reionization model works is that in advance, we work out where the density peaks were going to be using a fast PM, using some 2LBT structure formation code. And then in the highest peaks, we reionize a little bit first. So this is a dense halo, and then these lower density bits reionize a little later. In addition, I have massive neutrinos. I'm not going to talk about them because I talked about them last time I was here. I was really here last time, but now I'm just sort of here in spirit. We also have baryon relative velocities. So baryon relative velocities is the statement that the gas and the dark matter are moving relative to each other on small scales. That comes about because of the BAO. Essentially because there is a different transfer function for dark matter and baryons on large scales, and some patches of the universe, the baryons have a large relative velocity. This comes for free in our simulation because our box size is large enough that if you have the right transfer functions, if you have a baryon transfer function called a matter transfer function, and they're different, you will automatically get baryon relative velocities in different parts of the box. Okay, we haven't done anything with this yet, but it's in there. You can be clever and work out clever ways of treating this effect, or you can be a bit dumb and just increase the size of your simulation until it comes for free, and we've done the latter. This is the Asterix team. So this is myself, Tizian Demeter is the PI, Rupert Croft, Yufeng, who wrote a lot of the code, is now works for Google on TensorFlow, and Yeying Li, who is the grad student who did a lot of work for it. I've shown you this simulation. I've shown you that we can do a lot of high redshift stuff, and I'm kind of mentioning this here. Because one of the things that we could do is not just look at high redshift galaxies, but also, for example, 21 centimeter, other things in the epoch of reionization, right? So, if you have any ideas along these lines, the simulation data will soon be available to you if you have a sufficiently large bandwidth download, a few hundreds of terabytes. We've spent a long time running this simulation. Oh, sorry, is another question? I can only see Suvadeep's question. So if anyone else is asking a question, my apologies, but maybe someone can let me know.
I think Suvadeep asked questions on behalf of all of us.
Okay, well, please go ahead.
Because I have a question regarding your reionization model. So How do you model the escape function from the halos?
What we've done, so we don't explicitly model that yet. What we've done is we're using a model from Nick Battaglia from a few years ago. So what he did was he ran a radiative transfer simulation, basically. And this radiative transfer simulation, correlates the density field with the reionization redshift. And we take that correlation and we apply it on a very coarse-grained model of the density field in Asterix, sorry, in Asterid rather, the density field in Asterid, we pick the midpoint of reionization as a free parameter, right? So that takes care of the overall escape fraction normalization, and this midpoint is redshift 7.5.
Right, but in the next simulations, that depends very much on the halo masses you're considering. If you are really driven by heavier halos, then Nick's relationship significantly departs from how do you run it from the other case.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Right, so this is a fairly simplistic model of high shear reionization, right, at this point. This is the first thing that you can do that's inhomogeneous, basically. This is still a nice thing to do because everyone else who has been running these simulations has been assuming, that reionization happens instantaneously at some redshift. Partly that's just because the box sizes are a little bit smaller for most other people. we do have a branch of the code, and we have work in progress to use an actual excursion set model. So essentially what we've done is implemented 21 centimeter fast inside the code, and we'll rerun. This is a big box and this is expensive, but actually to run it down to Redshift, you know, 8, that is not that costly, right? It gets expensive, you know, after reionization has finished. So we're going to rerun this whole box down to Redshift 5 with 21 centimeter fast and see what happens.
Okay, thanks. Okay.
Yeah, but that's a very good question. Yes, Kier, ha. How nice to see you again.
Hi, Simeon. What heating and cooling rates are you using?
Yeah, so we're using Claude André's Fréchet-Giguère 2020. And we're using the optically thin background because, you know, he has two models for this, for his ultrafine background. One of them is including a model for the effective reionized fraction, basically. And one of them is just optically thin. And because our reionized fraction is included in this model already, we just use the optically thin version. So before something is reionized, it has essentially no heating whatsoever. It's as if the UVB is zero. And after it's reionized, it feels the UVB from Claude André Fréchet-Giguère 2020.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Simon.
No problem. This doesn't make any difference, but I did go through the code and make sure that the recombination rates and the collisional heating rates were all the most up-to-date values. And, you know, that changed things by like 0.5%. So whatever. Any more questions about this simulation before I... Okay. A problem that we have here is that this simulation took a long time, right? It was slow and it was expensive. You know, it's about to get to Redshift 2.8 is now it's about 3 million node hours on Frontera, this you know, ninth largest supercomputer in the world. So this was expensive. So the question is, how do we make it larger next time? How do we run a bigger simulation, given that computers are not going to get, you know, 10 to 8 times faster anytime soon? So we are drawn naturally towards machine learning, as in all of these things where we wish to solve enormous problems. So this is work that was really led by Ye-Ying Ni and Yin Li at the Flatiron. The idea here is that you can use machine learning to enhance the dynamic range. If you have ever watched Star Trek, The Next Generation, or one of these CSI shows, you know, there's a bit where he says, you know, switch on the view screen, and it's this fuzzy image of a planet, right? And then he says, enhance. And there's a sort of whirring noise, because that's how view screens work. And it goes click, 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 click. And all of a sudden, you can see people walking down on the planet in perfect, perfect resolution. And you watching this laugh and say, ha, 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 that is impossible. I know how diffraction works. Don't be silly, Captain Picard. Okay, so the point is, that's what this does. Okay, you say enhance, and by magic, you have a higher resolution simulation. Of course, this is impossible. So what am I doing here? This is not actually magic. How does this really work? This works. This works because it has seen a high-resolution simulation before, right? So, what we have here is we start off with a low-resolution simulation, and you've seen a high-resolution picture of something similar before, and the computer, you know, has optimized the mapping from low to high resolution. It knows the mapping from low to high resolution, so it's able to reproduce that mapping. So, you know, this is what a low resolution image looks like, and this is the computer science paper. This is a high resolution image, and the enhanced image kind of looks the same, right? So when we apply this to our simulations, you know, this is a low resolution image here on the left. This is a low resolution picture of galactic halo. This is a high resolution image of this halo, and this is the super resolution, right? So when we say super resolution, it's more, it reproduces a resolution like the high resolution. So it has seen something, you know, when Picard says enhance and it shows a picture of the planet, it knows what to do because it has seen a picture of a planet before, right? The magic is that it hasn't necessarily seen a picture of this planet. It's just seen a picture of a planet. So it knows there'll be some buildings, right? It knows the computer knows that when there's a low resolution high density blob here, it's going to look like a high density blob here. Okay. This works using generative adversarial networks. It learns the particle displacement field. So you start off, this is a Lagrangian space particle displacement. You start off at the initial time with the initial conditions in high resolution, and you learn how these initial particles are going to be displaced by the evolution, okay, from a mapping of the low resolution particle displacements. So the nice thing about this is it outputs a full particle snapshot. So any analysis that you were going to do on a full particle simulation, let's say you wanted to run an excursion set model, you can do on your super resolution image, okay?
How should I think of this? Sorry. So by low resolution, you just mean, you know, that you only feed it, let's say, like the low K modes. And so then is it like in some sense, you know, making like a realization of the missing high K modes? Like, is that how you should think of it? Or?
Yes, that's I think exactly how you should think of it. The way the training works is you have, so we had 64 cubes in 100 megaparsec box, and then we have a high resolution, which is 512 cubes. So when we do super resolution, the cosmology has to be the same, right? So the high resolution modes are the same, like the high resolution power spectrum is the same, right? It's not magic. It's not producing new information. It's producing new realizations of the same structure. So it's changing the phase modes basically. And because the power spectrum is the same in different parts of the universe is how this works. Yes, I think exactly you're right. Yeah.
So it's not like a Wiener filter reconstruction, you know, of like the average realization of the high K universe. It's like a particular realization, you're saying.
Right. So you can generate, you know what all the information is there, right? Because I'm showing you what the low resolution phase structure is, right? So the only thing that it's getting is I'm showing you what the initial conditions are for the high resolution, right? So it knows what the phases should be. It knows what the power spectrum should be because it's seen a high resolution box before, and it's able to put that together to make a realization of some part of the universe that it hasn't seen before, right? So you're putting in the cosmology, you're putting in the statistics, and you're pulling out an example of this. If that makes sense.
Okay, yeah, thanks. There's also a question from here, it looks like.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so just following up on that, in terms of the ensemble average power spectrum, you're giving it the relation between the low and the high K modes in the training data? So and you're then asking for effectively realizations. I realize you're doing this at the level of the displacement field.
Yeah, so we're not, you know, explicitly... it's not, we're not explicitly saying here is the power spectrum, right? A better way would to say that the model stores within it, within itself, the power spectrum, right? That's the thing that it's learned. It's learned a power spectrum, yeah. I think, but it's learned the power spectrum by learning the displacement.
Yeah. And you don't vary the cosmology, but you don't vary the baryonic description either.
I should have mentioned, this thing at the moment is only for M-body, right? So we have not yet published the baryonic prescription. It actually does work quite well. We did run it for Lyman alpha forest simulations, and you will see it, you know, in a few weeks to a month, a paper coming out that shows that it works pretty well for Lyman alpha forest. We haven't run it for full-on galaxy simulations yet, but you know, we'll get there.
You'll come to this, but Is there much more complexity in varying cosmology in terms of the network? Is it just sort of a few extra parameters in your network, or something much more?
That's a very That's a complicated question. So the first thing that you might want to do is to take this model that you've trained and use it, apply it to a lower resolution simulation with a different cosmology, right? And we've done that because that's pretty easy to do. All you need is another 64 cube simulation. It takes like 20 minutes, right? And it works somewhat. It works. It's like 5% accurate, basically, depending on how far away you are from the cosmology you put in. It works kind of about as well as HaloFit does. And I suspect that it works about as well as HaloFit does for similar reasons, the reasons that HaloFit works. I have a different clever machine learning-y trick for doing different cosmologies that I'm going to talk about a little later. This one, you know, in principle, you should retrain it for different cosmologies, I think. It might be that there's some ball in parameter space around which you can move without needing to retrain, but I don't know yet where that is.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So I'll tell you in a couple of slides. So I think Simon Foreman had a question.
Yeah, my question was actually exactly the same as Neil. How to think about this parameter space? I guess from what you're saying, it sounds like this method provides you a way to make a constrained realization of the small scale modes, which knows the correct coupling between the small and the large scale modes.
I think that's actually an excellent way of putting it. I had not put it to myself that way before, but yes, I think that's actually exactly how you should say it.
So if you ran this again, would it make like the same realization of the small scale modes or?
No, it makes somewhat different realizations of the small scale modes. That's a great question because it segues into my next slide. So you can run multiple draws from the same set of initial modes, and it will make slightly different realizations consistent with the statistics. This is at redshift zero. The realizations are not that different, this is at redshift two rather. The realizations are not that different, and I think that's partly because the low K modes actually constrain the statistics at high K pretty well, so there's not that much freedom. You can make multiple draws consistent with statistics, and so you can make multiple different realizations. I would like to invite you to play a game, which is to tell me which of these is the true high resolution simulation, and three of them are not. Which one is which? This is like one of those game shows where they ask you to work out which pile of clothes has been washed with the good detergent. I'm going to give you a second to think about it. A, B, C, or D. Everyone ready? Okay. A is the true answer.
No one voted that.
Yeah, it's hard, right? I can't really tell even. I do this. If I were to just tell you A is the real answer, you'd sit there and you'd be like, oh yeah, obviously I can see that A is the real answer because look at this bit here, right? It's a little bit different from over here. Now I ask you to pick it in advance. You can't do that. It's pretty hard to tell. The realization is actually quite good now. This is the power spectrum. This is not explicitly trained, right? I do suspect that it's in the model somewhere, that the model knows what this is because it's seen something like this before, but it's not explicitly trained, and the agreement is extremely good, right? I mean, you can't really tell the high resolution and super resolution, you can't tell the difference in this plot because they look so close. This is very good. This is like a few 1-2%. It's getting from the low resolution simulation here. So this is not bad. Another thing that you will be interested in is the Halo mass functions. These are also pretty good. They're a little less good than the power spectrum, but you know they're harder. And you know, this is the Halo mass at a redshift 4. This is the low resolution, right? So the super resolution is producing halos in a mass scale that are just not, you know, that they're just like small over densities at the resolution for low resolution simulation. So this is actually, I would say, pretty good. So I hope that, these three things, I mean, firstly asking you to pick this, and secondly showing the power spectrum, Halo mass function, convinces you that this kind of works, right? This machine learning model is well trained, like it does work. What is this for? Okay, so the immediate use for this is to generate unbelievably large mocks, right? So to use the fact that it's extreme realization to generate large mocks. So how do we do this? So we can run a low resolution field with about 1 gigaparsecs, with a box size of 1 gigaparsec with say 640 cubed. And then we can resimulate a small subsection of this at high resolution, right? We can chop out this small chunk of it from the low resolution box, train our super res model to go to high resolution in this small chunk, and then apply the super resolution model to all the rest of the box, right? Because from the perspective of the super resolution model, this is just a whole bunch of little boxes with different realizations stuck together, right? And so we get effectively an enormous mock with like 5,000 cubed particles, and we can use that to be a mock for our galaxy survey, or a mock for our 21 centimeter survey, or a mock for some Lyman alpha survey if it's Lyman alpha books. Okay, so that is the use case of this right now. Hopefully we can think of more use cases in the future, but this is what we can do right at this point. So essentially it's a way to combine you know, things at low resolution with things at high resolution together.
Oh, Simeon, there was a question in the chat. Probably you can't see it, or can
I can't
you?
See it. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah.
I can so only see what you can see me seeing.
Okay. Yeah. So the question was: is the super resolution applied just to upscale a single snapshot of the low res simulation, or instead is it applied dynamically throughout a simulation?
At the moment, it's to upscale a single snapshot. We would like to work on upscaling it dynamically. We haven't done that yet. We keep writing, that's just a lot of work, right? We haven't got there. We keep writing grants to do that, and someday we will get one and then we will do it. but yeah, we haven't done that yet. Matthew Johnson, hello.
Hello. So you train the model on a single high resolution snapshot. And the thing I was wondering is, have you tried to train it on multiple little volumes so that you could incorporate the effects of you know, the feedback of the large scale environment on the small scales?
Yeah, so
like, does your model know about super sample variance in a way, or?
It does know about super sample variance. So that's kind of, yeah, that's actually pretty much how this works already. So you can't fit the whole high resolution simulation into memory on a GPU. So what it actually does is it chops it into small chunks and it trains on a small chunk. So it does, the fact that this works at all means that yes, it knows about that.
Okay, thanks.
Any more questions, or should I? Okay, so part three. Okay, so you know, I've explained that we need to retrain for every new cosmology. So how can we do cosmological parameter estimation? You know, how do we do that better? So the way that we do cosmological parameter estimation is that we build an emulator. You know, we often want to have multiple simulations of different initial conditions, different cosmologies. And the way we do that is that we have a suite of like 20 to 200 or so of these guys. We estimate the, and we kind of interpolate between them, right? We take a summary statistic and we build the output of these simulations from our existing subset of summary statistics, you know, without actually running the cosmological parameters in between them, we are able to predict it. This is a problem akin to having an early map of the world where you've been to Nova Scotia here, and someone has been to Brazil, and you suspect that they connect. So you sort of guess, you draw something that looks a bit like a coastline going between them, right? So, you know, this guy has never been here. He somehow knows the Pacific Ocean there, despite the fact that no one from Europe had ever been there yet. He kind of, you know, makes an interpolation between them. So this is kind of what we want to do, right? Except we want to do this to about 1% to get enough accuracy to analyze upcoming cosmological simulations. So the normal way to do this is to take a bunch of simulations, 50 or so, and to use Gaussian processes to interpolate between them. You know, you can think of a Gaussian process as kind of a Bayesian function interpolation, or I think of it like that. You know, it computes a probability distribution of a function f of x contingent on an input set at a set of parameters. The magic in the Gaussian process is in the kernel function, which describes how different points are correlated as a function of the difference between their parameters, the distance between their parameters. You know, this works really well, right? This works to like 1%. You know, this is the output of Lyman Alpha emulator that Kier was involved in. And it works to like 1%. It's great. However, you know, you need to run 50 high resolution simulations, right? You need to find the best simulation you can afford and run 50 copies of them. And you know, naively you think, okay, why are we needing to do this? Because some parts of these simulations are the same, right? Some the fact that this guy works or that Halofit works suggests that a lot of the small scale information is actually kind of the same in all simulations. So can we do better than this? So with my student Mingfeng Ho, I've been working on this thing. We've been working on this multi-fidelity emulation. So the idea here is that you have two sets of simulations at different resolutions. So you have a few high resolution simulations. These high resolution simulations get you how the small scales behave. And then you have a large number of low resolution simulations, and that maps out your cosmological parameter space. So the idea here is that you can afford many low resolution simulations and just a few high fidelity simulations. So the high fidelity simulations can be run on your big supercomputer. The low resolution simulations you can run on like a workstation or a small supercomputer. This is kind of akin to splicing or Rayleigh scaling, where you pick your best fit and you run one high resolution simulation, and then you multiply every other power spectrum anywhere else in the box by a correction function, which is given by the difference between your low resolution and high resolution simulations at this particular point. Yeah, Suvadi.
Yeah, I've slightly confused maybe with something. So how do you take into account the stochasticity because of baryonic physics?
Right. What we do is we add an extra parameter which models the parameters of the baryonic physics model in practice.
And you may not know the statistics of that distribution, right? I mean, how that parameter is going to vary from depending on the environment is not right now clear to us.
I see. Okay. Yes. That's right. So you're asking. You're saying essentially that this depends on the cosmology, right?
Right. I mean.
Right. So
yeah.
So the new thing about this is that the correction between the high fidelity and low fidelity model can depend on cosmology, right? So we run multiple high fidelity models, and as long as there are if we run enough of them, you know, even if the baryonic physics is very dependent on cosmology, you can run, you know, you can always just run more high fidelity models, and then you will get a converged answer, right? That wouldn't be useful compared to just running the high fidelity models in the first place, right? So to be useful, this relies on the number of high fidelity simulations being lower than the total number of simulations. I'm going to assert that this is in fact the case, right? But this, you know, how useful this is a quantitative question, right? Mm-hmm. At the moment, we've only done this for n-body simulations, right? This is a first paper, but I think I believe that it works relatively well even with baryonic physics in, and you know, this is not yet published. Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. So what I'm going to talk about is just mBody for now. So the way this works is we train, you know, how does this work? It works because we train two Gaussian processes. So we train one Gaussian process on the low resolution simulations, and then we train a multiplicative factor, which is cosmology dependent, that gets you a high resolution, and this thing here, which is kind of like an additive correction term. And we optimize the training set, optimizes the hyperparameters of this correction term and this additive term. Sorry, the slide's in the wrong place. We have a second trick, which is quite clever. So the high resolution simulations are a subset of the low resolution simulations, and we pick the high resolution simulations to simulate after running all the low resolution simulations. So essentially what we do is we remove a couple of low resolution simulations and we see which low resolution simulations, which set of cosmological parameters have the most predictive power at improving the performance of the low fidelity emulator. And we rerun those at high resolution. So this is a trick that beats random Latin hypercube sampling because it puts the high resolution simulations exactly where it is most useful, okay? Because you know, we know what the power spectrum is from the low resolution simulations, and we assume that the errors in interpolation are correlated with high resolution and low resolution. And then we put these things in places where we know that they are well separated in the posterior parameter space, in the high resolution power spectrum, rather than in the prior parameter space of the cosmological parameters. Okay, so this is kind of neat. We ran a proof of concept emulator and it works quite well. So I've shown here the error on the matter power spectrum. This is just an mBody matter power spectrum. This is the first, you know, most simplest thing you can imagine. This is the error with three high resolution simulations, this SF3, and it's not, you know, three high resolution simulations is not a very good emulator, right? The green line is the error with about 11 high resolution simulations, and this is a much better emulator. This blue line is the error with three high resolution simulations and 50 low resolution simulations. So this is the same number of simulations as low resolution and much better cosmological parameter estimation. On large scales, because the large scales are resolved in the low fidelity simulation, this is as accurate as an emulator with 50 high resolution simulations, right? And that kind of has to be the case because all the information on these scales is already contained in the low resolution simulations. Okay. It's as good as running 11 or so high resolution simulations at small scales because it turns out the correction term is almost independent of cosmology. Why is this? So, this is a worst case error. I'm going to skip over this because I'm short of time. The worst case error is about 2%. It's probably dominated by the fact that we only have three high resolution simulations and the resolution of our high resolution simulations is actually not that great. So this could easily be stochasticity in the high resolution simulations, right? If we had a better simulation, I think this would get a little bit smaller on small scales. Why does this work? It is my thought that this works because of the Halo model, right? It works for the same reason that Halo fit works. Halo fit has a two Halo term learned by, and the two Halo term is learned by the low fidelity simulations. There is on small scales, a correction to high resolution. And that is a one Halo term. The one Halo term is almost cosmology independent in the same way that Halo fit is almost independent of cosmological parameters. And so because of this, it can learn the one Halo term with only a few high resolution simulations, okay? So that is why I think this works. As further evidence for this, this model is good at redshift 0 and 1, so here, and then somewhat less good at redshift 2. Why is that? I think it's because redshift 2, the low fidelity is too linear, right? There's not enough of a quasi-linear mode in the low fidelity simulation for the model to get a handle on it. And because of this, it fails a little bit on the small scales. This is a plot to convince you that this is worth doing. This is the cost in terms of running a simulation. This is the error here, and this is the cost in terms of compute time of running simulations. This is a high fidelity emulator going from 2 simulations all the way to 11. So this is what you would normally do before this paper. And this is a multi-fidelity simulation, increasing the number of low fidelity simulations we have here. You can see it gets pretty good when you have about 50 of them, and then it stops getting better much until you got 400. In conclusion, I've introduced a little bit Cosmos simulations. I've introduced my new simulation, our new simulation, which is the Astra simulation, which is very large. It's a 250 megaparsec box with 5,500 cubes in particles. This is the same box size as for example, multi-dark. This is the same box size that people have historically run dark matter only simulations in, and it has more physics in it. It dominates them. I've shown you this machine learning trick that we have, which is currently only for embodied simulations, which is designed to increase the effective scale of simulation and to make enormously large mocks. And then I've shown the parameter estimation trick that we have, which is to build an emulator from not just a whole bunch of high resolution simulations, but to combine a few simulations at high resolution with some simulations at low resolution. The next steps is to combine these things together. To build a hydro emulator from simulations like Astrid, and to use Astrid as a training set for this machine learning trick to increase its effective scale and make a much larger effective box. I also want to take our existing emulators, which have only a few parameters, and expand it in different dimensions with our multi-fidelity model. So for example, to expand them to some non-trivial dark matter parameters. This has to be possible because there is absolutely no way that my multi-fidelity emulator, which has 5 simulations, there's no way that these 3 high-fidelity simulations, sorry, my multi-fidelity emulator with 5 parameters, there's no way that these 3 high-fidelity simulations are linearly spanning a 6-dimensional parameter space, right? So it ought to be possible to take a 5-dimensional parameter space and expand it to 8 dimensions without needing more high-fidelity simulations. Okay. So that's everything. Thank you very much for listening. I went a little bit over, but that's okay because you asked great questions.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Simeon. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for his great talk. Okay, so any further questions for Simeon? People can feel free just to jump in, or if you want to, also you can raise your hand. Either way is fine. Well, maybe I can start off. I think I was maybe missing something here in the final part of your talk.
Sorry,
so you're talking about emulating several summary statistics, like the power spectrum or whatever. I didn't maybe catch how that helps you solve the problem you mentioned earlier about making a large enough training set for your machine learning algorithm, right? Because there, presumably you want like full realizations, not just a few summary statistics for all the various different cosmologies and various different baryon parameters. So can you just maybe say a bit more about that?
That's absolutely true. Sorry. It does not solve that problem.
Oh, okay.
Right. So yes, no, it doesn't solve that problem. It does, but it gets you what you probably want, right? Which is it gets you a summary statistic that you can compare to a simulation, to a survey rather. It doesn't do that.
Okay.
So the full problem of generating arbitrary cosmology simulations remains a problem, and I think it might be difficult to do that in general, because the physics changes, right? I mean, these things aren't magic; they can't produce information from nowhere. There's probably a ball in parameter space where you can do it, but yeah.
Okay, any further questions? Okay, if not, then let's thank Simeon again.
Thank you very much for having me.